Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 110, Spiritual Emergencies and Spiritual Competencies, September 9th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The Spiritual Emergency Network was founded by Stan and Christina Groff at Esalen back in like 1980, and I became involved with it right at the get-go. And throughout the 80s, we held a number of both working conferences at Esalen and also public conferences on this, and many other SENs were developed around the world. And in 1989, we had a conference in Monterey with about 500 people looking at issues of spiritual emergency and how to get more recognition for the fact that people can get into some serious trouble through spiritual practices or psychedelics, or sometimes even spontaneously, that can look like a major mental disorder, like psychosis of some sort, and yet be, in fact, a kind of self-healing, transformative crisis if it's allowed to, if it's treated that way and a person is allowed to go through that experience.
That was the voice of my guest, David Lukov. David Lukov, Ph.D., has been a clinical psychologist for 25 years and is currently a professor of psychology at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. He's also taught at Harvard, UCLA, Oxnard College, Saybrook Graduate School, and the Institute of Integral Studies, as well as having led workshops around the world. Much of his clinical experience has been with patients suffering from serious mental disorders. He reports that he has found spirituality to be a central part of the recovery process for most patients. Much of his treatment approach arises from a brief psychotic experience he had, which lasted 2 months. Spirituality played a key role in his own recovery. Dr. Lukov was instrumental in getting a new diagnostic category, religious or spiritual problem, accepted into the DSM-4. Much of his current focus is training other mental health professionals in spiritual competency, that is, to recognize and know how to work with spiritual issues in their clinical work. He's author of 70 articles and chapters on spiritual issues and mental health. He's also designed and taught online courses for the past 12 years. His Spiritual Competency Resource Center provides access to online resources that enhance the cultural sensitivity of mental health professionals, including online courses, guides to internet resources, and articles on the clinical applications of spirituality. Now, here's the interview. David Lukov, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
Well, it's nice to be here. I wish I could, maybe I'll take a picture before I leave, but my listeners, I wish I could paint an adequate word picture for you. I'm in David's office, which is attached, it's kind of outside the main dwelling.
Detached.
Yeah. It's detached, and I guess at one time it must have been a garage?
A work shed.
A work shed. Beautifully converted. Inside is kind of like I was remarking earlier, like it was in this lovely little hobbit house here. So it's very nice. It's lined with bookcases and looks like little toys maybe
sand
for Sands.
Yes.
For Sands.
Union. Which my wife does.
Okay. Yes. That's great. Maybe I'll have to interview her at some point. I don't think I've interviewed anybody about sand play work yet. So maybe she'd be up there, up for that. Well, you have a very varied, a long and varied career, and there are lots of different directions we could go. But I thought maybe I'd start with one of the things that you're sort of very identified with right now, as far as I know, which is a something that you direct called the Resource Center for Spiritual Competency. So maybe you can start off by telling us, what do you mean by spiritual competency?
Well, it's a kind of an evolving concept, but the term occurred to me when I was involved in a training program at Saybrook Graduate School, where all faculty and staff were being familiarized with issues around cultural competency. And I've been working in the area of spirituality and clinical practice and their overlap for about 25 years. And I started to see many parallels with the kinds of arguments that are made for multicultural competency. That has been recognized now since the early 90s as just an essential part of what any psychologist needs to know in order to function professionally. And social work and nursing and psychiatry have all also evolved similar guidelines for addressing religious and spiritual issues of clients, both for just respecting their background, being knowledgeable about their faith, and also even at times knowing when it would be appropriate to make referrals to religious professionals, or in some cases to actually make use of some spiritual interventions, whether it's meditation or forgiveness work or things like that, all of which have spawned, been spawned from spiritual practices that now have been kind of repurposed in the mental health field as mind-body interventions. So it includes a broad array of things.
Okay, so and having studied the site a bit, then it's really oriented then towards therapists and other kinds of mental health practitioners to bring up their level of competency in terms of dealing with these kinds of spiritual issues. Is that right?
So I have training modules on my website that deal with how to conduct a culturally sensitive spiritual assessment of clients.
Okay.
And there's several different approaches, both verbal approaches, which are based on structured interviews, but there's also some nonverbal approaches where people kind of draw their spiritual journey.
Okay. This may be a tough question, but people use the word spiritual in different ways on occasion. And so how do you define spirituality?
Currently, there has been, I'd say it's almost a consensus, but there's some disagreement in the literature about where to draw the boundaries between religion and spirituality. Boundaries were not drawn between those two terms. If you look at the Oxford English Dictionary, for example, they were synonymous up until the late 60s. And even people like Abraham Maslow, when trying to address what we're now talking about as spirituality, used to talk about religion with a small r and religion with a large r. And this more universal religion with a large r is now what many people talk about as spirituality. And even the major scientific literature databases, such as PubMed and PsycINFO, draw this kind of a distinction. Typically, it is that spirituality pertains to an individual's relationship to a higher power or a higher purpose, a source of meaning in life that may or may not be involved with any organized religions.
Mm-hmm. Interesting that it came about in the 60s. That makes me wonder if it was part of the sort of larger rebellion against a lot of established ideas.
It was definitely part of that. I talked with a historian of psychiatry, Eugene Taylor, who might be a very interesting person for this program
mm-hmm.
as well.
Okay.
And he has, I've asked him actually if he could pin down who started to use these terms this way, and he mentioned that Alan Watts was one of the first. He doesn't know if he was the first, but he was one of the first to start using that term this way to make a distinction between religion, the more organized mm-hmm. forms of expression with a set dogma and a hierarchical set of personnel who are overseeing practices, rituals, and so on, versus the individual's relationship to the domain of the transcendent.
Yeah, you know, there's a more recent evolution, I think, that I'm noticing among some of my friends who refer to spirit in the context that other people might have said God. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll say something along the lines of, I don't know if I can think of a good example, but spirit tells me, or I'm communing with spirit, or, you know, so that somehow the word spirit has evolved in a way that feels less entrapped, I guess, than we felt entrapped by the word God, as implying some kind of, as you said, hierarchical, institutional conceptions.
Right. This is really a conundrum for researchers, because once people start to actually try to research spirituality versus religion, the differences kind of seem to almost disappear. There are now about 30% of people in this culture, according to Gallup polls, who will say they are spiritual but not religious. And about something like 50% who will say they are both, and 20% who will say that they are religious but not spiritual. But then when you start to do more intensive qualitative interviews with these people, it's really hard to see any consistent pattern to what people are drawing as the distinction. So it really has been difficult on the research level to make any clear statements about this. But people's self-definitions are certainly changing, and many people are seeing that their spiritual, where their source of their spirituality, much of it comes from outside of organized churches.
Well, I know you've done a lot of research in this area yourself, and also you're on the faculty of the Saybrook Institute, our graduate school, Saybrook Graduate School.
Well, let me make a correction there, because
has the name changed?
September 1st came around, I'm now full-time on the faculty of the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology.
Oh.
So after 19 years at Saybrook, I have jumped ships.
Oh, my goodness, yes, I wasn't aware of this.
Schools.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I was about to say is, I'm sure you've supervised a lot of research and a lot of dissertations probably that have been in this area of spirituality. So you would be well acquainted with the challenges and conundrums.
Yes. And I also have written quite a number of articles, like 70 plus articles.
Wow.
And chapters that deal with this issue of spirituality. And many of them have included extensive literature reviews. I'm writing one right now for, as part of the work group that I'm on for the DSM-5, Work Group on Religious and Spiritual Issues. And we're putting together a book on religious and spiritual issues in diagnosis. And my particular chapter is about religious and spiritual problems. So this is an area I've been working in for many years. It started with my work on spiritual emergencies or spiritual crises, and it's now expanded into a number of other domains of treatment where spirituality plays a role. You know, it's for many years I've also headed a dual diagnosis program dealing with people who had drug and alcohol problems, and spirituality is certainly recognized there as an important part of recovery. I also work with the recovery movement for patients with serious and persistent mental disorders, and they are also embracing a spiritually oriented recovery model. And my wife and I do work in the area of spirituality in aging, illness, grief, and dying, which is another, these are all areas where there is recognition mm-hmm. in the literature that spirituality plays a significant role. There's many other areas where you can find fewer articles, fewer acknowledgement that spirituality plays a role, for example, in couples therapy. There's a rather sparse literature. There is some on spirituality in couples therapy, but it's not nearly as extensive as what you'll find, for example, if you look at grief.
Yes, yes. Well, the research that seems to include some element of spirituality does indeed seem to be exploding. For example, in one of my podcast series, I've been interviewing some people who have developed cutting-edge therapies, which have a lot of research behind them, which integrate concepts from Zen and Eastern thought, mainly mindfulness. So they're at least two major approaches that integrate behavior therapy with mindfulness. And whoever, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, that would have been kind of an unthinkable integration. And now, it's kind of mainstream.
Yes. And I was going to say that except for the field of transpersonal psychology,
right,
one of the reasons that field was founded was because it seemed to many of us, I'm now the co-president of the Association for Transpersonal Psychology, but it seemed to many of us that there were many very obvious issues that mainstream psychology, including humanistic psychology, were not paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was spirituality. And Daniel Goleman, who of course now is quite famous for his work on emotional intelligence, he started off in the area of meditation, edited some books, wrote many articles on meditation, and his earliest articles were, in fact, published in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology back in the 70s. And Ram Dass, as far as I can tell, in reviewing this literature, wrote the very first articles on the use of meditation in therapy. There had been some acknowledgement through Herbert Benson's work that meditation had very beneficial effects on the autonomic system for people who had high blood pressure and things like that. But Ram Dass was really the first one to make a case for using mindfulness techniques as a adjunct to psychotherapy.
Interesting.
Which now, as you say, has become quite mainstream.
Yeah, yeah. He had an influence on me, certainly, when I was at the tail end of my graduate studies. And just to put in a plug for myself, you'll find a short article by me in the 1971 Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. So I did get a little lick in there early on. Well, it was an outgrowth of my doctoral dissertation, which was about the role of attention in meditation and hypnosis. And so there's something about meditation in there early on.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different directions that we could go from things that you've said. And you made mention of the DSM-4, and I know that you made a contribution to that. And maybe you could just briefly say what that was.
Yeah. Well, this grew out of the work that I was doing on spiritual emergencies. The Spiritual Emergency Network was founded by Stan and Christina Groff at Esalen back in like 1980, and I became involved with it right at the get-go. And throughout the 80s, we held a number of both working conferences at Esalen and also public conferences on this and many other SENs were developed around the world. And in 1989, we had a conference in Monterey with about 500 people looking at issues of spiritual emergency and how to get more recognition for the fact that people can get into some serious trouble through spiritual practices or psychedelics or sometimes even spontaneously that can look like a major mental disorder like psychosis of some sort. And yet, be in fact a kind of self-healing transformative crisis if it's treated that way and a person is allowed to go through that experience. So at that conference, one of the conclusions was that a very powerful way to increase awareness of spiritual emergencies would be to get a diagnostic category into the next DSM, which was in production at that point. I mean, in process at that point. This was, as I say, 89. And Francis Liu and Robert Turner, a little bit later, who are both psychiatrists, affiliated with UCSF Medical School, and I then kind of took that on.
And that must have been a challenge, I would think.
Well, it was both a challenge, and we were also very worried that we would be spending, you know, a few years kind of tilting at windmills.
Yeah.
But it ended up that we were successful. There's a lot of politics involved in this, and I have written an article that's on my website that traces the history of this, the role that the editor of the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease played by publishing our proposal as a lead article in the journal, fast-tracking it so that it came out in time for the DSM committee to see this major article in a major psychiatric journal. Getting support from some of the subcommittees within the American Psychiatric Association, such as the Committee on Psychiatry and Religion, which supported our proposal, and also a work group on subcultural issues supported our proposal. So we did a lot of, you know, politicking for this, as well as putting together a comprehensive literature review that documented the occurrence of religious and spiritual problems in therapy and treatment, and also how little training mental health professionals are given in this area, so that they're really not prepared to deal with these problems when they are brought up in therapy.
So you got a new category added to the DSM-IV, which was called Spiritual and Religious Emergency?
Actually, we naively started with the idea of proposing the term spiritual emergency.
Okay.
As we looked more closely at the structure of the DSM, we realized that that would really not fit in with the way they talk about these terms. So in the section of the DSM called Other Conditions Which May Be the Focus of Clinical Attention But Are Not Mental Disorders, we found things like bereavement, marital or actually partner relational problem, things that are acknowledged to be the focus of treatment but aren't, you know, there's no pathophysiological or biochemical imbalance or anything like that presumed as part of that. So we started to shoot for that category, and to make it consistent with the other categories that were there, we changed the terminology to problem. So, and we ended up proposing, actually, in our 1992 proposal, a category that we termed psycho-religious or psycho-spiritual problem.
Okay.
So that's what we actually proposed. The DSM-IV task force dropped the psycho part, even though we felt there were pure religious and spiritual problems that one might consult a religious professional or a spiritual teacher about, in contrast to psycho-religious or psycho-spiritual, but they were uncomfortable with that terminology and just dropped it. And we also went back and forth a number of times about the need to include spiritual in the diagnosis, because they came back kind of with a counter-proposal to just use religious problem. So we had to prepare another kind of paper arguing as to why spiritual problem would make the diagnostic category more comprehensive, and that there are many people who have problems that are outside of the domain of organized religion but still are self-defined certainly as a spiritual issue.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you're working on a committee now in relation to DSM-5, which would be the next version. What are you pushing for now?
Well, this is a work group that I'm on. There are about 11 psychiatrists on this work group, and I'm on it as the only psychologist. And we have been holding monthly telephone meetings, and we're trying to pull together all the literature that deals with religion and diagnosis. So, as I mentioned, my particular niche is religious and spiritual problem. George Vallian is on the committee. Koenig is on the committee. These are people who have extensive publications in these areas. And each of us are taking one of the major 12 categories of the DSM, so mood disorders, psychotic disorders, anxiety disorders, and so on, and reviewing the literature. From that, we are going to propose specific language that could be incorporated into the DSM-5 that would address unique religious and spiritual issues for each diagnostic category.
Interesting. Well, that'll be very interesting to see how that turns out.
Then we'll make our proposal, and then, of course, we have no way of knowing what will actually get incorporated. But, you know, we're doing it in a way that we're already part of the DSM process. So I think our voice will be heard. We're still not sure to what degree.
Okay. Now, I think I saw this on your website that perhaps some of your interest and passion for this whole area comes out of an experience that you had of spiritual emergency or psychosis or whatever. Is that something you'd be comfortable talking about?
Yeah, I did not share this experience for many years, for almost 20 years after I had it. Started a lot of my work by publishing case studies of other people who had experiences that were actually very similar to my own.
Okay.
But that's how I kind of started, and I published four other case studies, and several of them are on my website, as a way to document this phenomenon. And then later, as a result of doing that over a period of about 8 or 9 years, I did feel emboldened to go ahead and write up my own experience. And in a nutshell, this was something that I experienced back in 1971. I had been a graduate student at Harvard in anthropology and came to what I would actually say is much more of an existential crisis about who am I. I was 23. I was already starting to work on had my master's degree, working on my doctoral dissertation, and I had a whole crisis around who was I, and my whole life feeling totally set out before me, and so on. And I basically rather suddenly, within a couple of months, made the decision to drop out of Harvard, get rid of everything I owned that would not fit into a backpack, and I started to hitchhike around the United States.
Well, I had that fantasy when I was in graduate school. I didn't do it, but I definitely wrestled with that.
Well, I took that plunge, and it landed me in San Francisco at some point, and somebody, you know, just culturally, it was still the 60s, even though it was 1971. We call the 60s is more like 65-ish to maybe 73 or so.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I was offered some LSD, and feeling like I was on the road to find out and try new things, I took it for the first time. And it catapulted me into this state where I just was convinced that I was a reincarnation of Buddha and a reincarnation of Jesus Christ, and had a mission to write a new holy book that was going to change the world.
Okay.
And I spent about a week writing this book, hardly sleeping, taking a nap here and there, you know. Certainly would have met the criteria at the time, DSM-2, for an acute schizophrenic episode. But I was just holed up writing this book, had about 40 copies of it Xeroxed, sent maybe half of them to my family and friends, literally gave out the other half on the streets of Berkeley, just handed them out.
Yeah.
And then I spent about the next 2 months kind of waiting to be discovered, kind of, you know, feeling very entitled, like I was going to be the prophet of this new religion, so I didn't have any need to kind of support myself or take care of myself.
Were you hearing any voices or having visions or
during
anything
that
of that
week
sort?
When I was writing that book, I was having constant conversations with not only Buddha and Christ, but Rousseau and Locke about the social contract, because I was going to be writing a new social contract. I was talking with Freud and Jung about the psyche and how to shape that, with people like Margaret Mead, because I thought I was wanted this to be a universal cross-cultural experience. I was talking with Bob Dylan and Cat Stevens about how to get a message out into the world, you know, mass media, you know.
Did they have good things to say?
Oh, at the time, I thought they were, like, sitting on my shoulder giving me wonderful advice about how to do all that. So those were what would be called inner voices, or, you know, mm-hmm. inner auditory hallucinations, because they were definitely inside my head, is what was my sense of them, rather than outside.
Okay.
Really hard to distinguish in that level between thoughts and voices. I did later. I came to a crisis about 2 months later because, well, I should mention that I do consider myself very lucky in that I had some very good friends who basically put me up, let me crash with them, fed me, you know, just took care of me, kind of the way that some of these centers that were opened up in the 70s in San Francisco, like Soteria and Diabasis.
That was John Perry, right?
John Perry.
Jungian analyst.
That's mm-hmm. right. Jungian analyst. He opened up a center in San Francisco where people who were having first break psychotic episodes could be allowed to go through them without medication, and had a very high success rate. And there's been some excellent research on Soteria House, which was very similar. And they did 2-year longitudinal follow-ups that showed superior outcomes for the people who were treated without medications. And actually, I'm involved now in a project to revive a Soteria House environment for first break psychotic patients.
Yeah, what happened to those experiments? We had those two. We also had R.D. Lang, who was doing something similar.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I haven't heard of anything like that in recent years.
Well, it became the accepted conventional wisdom that anybody who showed psychotic symptoms needed early intervention with neuroleptic medication. That became the conventional accepted standard of practice.
It's cheaper, it's faster.
And the pharmaceutical companies were just ramming this up everybody's butt at every single American mm-hmm. Psychiatric Association conference, and actually distorting the evidence. There's a guy you might be interested in interviewing who did a reanalysis of the actual data from Soteria House and demonstrated in some really groundbreaking studies that have been published in peer-reviewed journals like Schizophrenia Bulletin and Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, and it's been written up now in the New York Times and so on, that in fact the outcome for patients treated without medication was by and large superior in terms of the 2-year outcomes, rehospitalization, social functioning, occupational functioning, and so on. And it's just the power of the pharmaceutical companies in cahoots with, you know, the agencies that it supports, like the American Psychiatric Association, that has just mowed down all of the places that have tried to do anything alternative.
I certainly believe that.
And we now have another window of opportunity, though, I think, to revisit this. And I'm hopeful that we're in Alameda County, there are a few of us who are looking at some possibilities to open up a Soteria like. So anyway, I did actually, 2 months later, on my own, just with being able to be, supported, come through this experience. On my own, no medication, no hospitalization. And then I went through a period of being very, you know, embarrassed about it, and went into a period, I'd say, of being pretty depressed about what a foolish thing I'd done, both in sending out this book to everybody I knew and dropping out of Harvard and all this kind of stuff. And it really was a voice experience. A genuine hallucination, because this one was actually something I heard outside of my head later that kind of turned me around. And I was going through some difficulties. I was even recurrence of a chronic condition I have called Crohn's disease, and was in a lot of pain. And at that point, I was just by myself in a cottage in Cape Cod. It was a summer cottage of my parents. And I was actually seriously considering suicide.
Sure.
And it was during that time that I was also in the habit of taking a daily walk along the ocean, and I heard this voice. And all I heard it say was one thing, one time, and it said, "Become a healer." And I actually turned around thinking there was somebody next to me.
Wow.
But it kind of became like a mantra or a koan, you know, like, mm-hmm. what does this mean, become a healer? Mm-hmm. Does it mean I should go to medical school? Does it mean I should study herbs? But that started to, instead of having all these kind of depressogenic, thoughts and regrets and recriminations and so on. It gave me a kind of prospective orientation of like, well, how would I become a healer? What training would I get? What should I explore? And so on. And over a period of a few years of starting to get into, I experimented with, you know, courses in herbs and yoga and encounter groups and things like that. I began to really get involved with the whole growth group and counter group movement and became a group facilitator for a couple of years and so on. And then that's what led me back into graduate school in psychology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Me too. I got very involved in that encounter group business as well. Your episode was triggered by psychedelics. What's your take on psychedelics at this point, in terms of either their utility, their danger?
Well, I think of them as incredibly potent tools if used the right way. I think the way I took it was relatively safe, in that I was just taking it by myself out in nature. I think ideal way to take it, especially for somebody who is either seeking some therapeutic benefit or doing it certainly for the first time, would be to do it with a guide who knew what they were doing.
Yes.
And there are some new models for using psychedelics in that way, both in the kind of neo-shamanic psychedelic underground.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just published a chapter that I co-authored as the second author that deals with these new, much more conscious, intentional use of psychedelic drugs in group settings, with a facilitator, with ritual, and so on. And on the other hand, we're also seeing a resurgence of the use of psychedelic drugs in therapy protocols that have been approved by the FDA and NIDA and so on. For example, there's one at UCLA with Dr. Charles Grobe, where he's working with people who have terminal diagnoses using,
yes,
I think it's now psilocybin. I think he originally wanted to use MDMA, but they balked and put so many roadblocks in front of that he's now using psilocybin. But there's other studies where they are using MDMA with people with PTSD. There's another study that was approved using LSD with people with drug and alcohol problems and so on. There's about a dozen, I believe, studies that have been approved now for using psychedelics in a much more careful manner with appropriate, you know, trained therapists to guide the experience and so on. But it seems to me, from having reviewed some of that literature, that's been 17 years ago that I did that. But even back then, I can see that the early research actually looked very promising for the use of psychedelic drugs with certain defined clinical.
Yeah, drugs. It did look very promising, and then the baby kind of got thrown out with the bathwater when the whole legal thing came down, and because of abuses that everybody's familiar with. But so I'm glad to hear that there is a resurgence of sanctioned, carefully thought out research, because I do see these substances as powerful tools that can cut both ways, and so they have to be wielded properly,
right,
in order to cut the right way. And certainly as you were telling your story, I couldn't help but think of it as a kind of shamanic call or a shamanic experience, and I know you've written about that, and that in another culture, you might have, somebody who had the experience that you had would have been treated in a special way, and it would have been recognized as, okay, this person has had some kind of special calling here, and, you know, maybe can be put to good use for the group.
Right. And I, you know, certainly once I started to look into this experience, I later went into Jungian analysis for 5 years,
oh, okay,
to help integrate it and so on. And I began to see that there are, you know, John Perry has been pointing these kinds of things out, R.D. Lang has been pointing these things out, but you can find, you know, a much longer history of acknowledgement of this kind of phenomenon, even going back to Socrates, who talked about divine madness.
Yes. Now, is it complicated by the possibility that there are different kinds of psychotic experiences or etiologies? So it's hard to know, isn't it?
Yes, there's definitely issues of differential diagnosis. Mm-hmm. There are episodes that I think overlap both the spiritual crisis and mental disorder domain. And in fact, a lot of my work now has been with people who have, mental disorders, take medication, are on SSI, struggling to, live a fruitful, meaningful life, but who think that as part of their psychotic episodes, they were having genuine spiritual experiences that were ignored, and that potentially those could be very important components of their recovery. So I do think there's areas of overlap. I think there's also people who have mental disorders with perhaps a voice experience from God or something like that, but who really are not constitutionally capable of integrating that.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting distinction, not constitutionally capable of integrating it. I like that.
Yeah. So it's kind of a Venn diagram. So you can have spiritual crises, you can have mental disorders, and you can have this area of overlap.
Yes. Yeah, because I knew a fellow in graduate school when I was at the University of Michigan, and he came out to California, and he had been taking a lot of LSD and other things off and on, and he flipped out, and people, the circle of friends, of graduate school friends, some of whom had already preceded him in coming out to California, they really tried to take care of him. They tried to provide that supportive circle that you were fortunate to have. It didn't work. He just deteriorated more and more and more until he had alienated everybody and lost all resources, and we don't know what became of him, but he's probably not alive today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A very sad story.
Well, I have actually written, in fact, I have an article that was just published in June on visionary spiritual experiences, and I was pleased to be invited to write this article because it was in a fairly mainstream medical journal, the Southern Medical Journal, indexed in Medline and all that, but it's the kind of thing that goes out to a lot of, people in, just general practice kinds of settings, mm-hmm. and where a lot of these issues can come up. So I actually did systematically review the literature on prognosis and came up with a number of good prognostic indicators that can be used, even though we can't be sure mm-hmm. of who's going to come through these experiences. There are definitely some signs like acute onset, good premorbid functioning, an exploratory attitude toward the experience. These have actually been validated in a number of longitudinal studies as predictors of good outcomes. So I've argued, even though this isn't based on prospective research, based on retrospective research, that those are likely candidates for markers, and it's one of the things that we're interested in actually doing some prospective research as part of this soteria.
Okay, well, you know what? I think we're going to have to close off. We could go on for hours and hours here because there are so many other areas I would like to explore with you. I had intended to get into your whole involvement with the online world because mm-hmm. interesting for somebody who is involved in everything that we've just talked about to be so also at the same time so heavily involved in online education. So maybe that will be for some future discussion.
I'd enjoy that. Also have some beliefs around how the online world has actually been a great facilitator of global spirituality.
I think we'll have to have a second interview if that's okay with you.
I enjoy that, sure.
Dr. David Lukoff, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Together, all part of this humankind. Shrink Wrap Radio, you will find you. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
Hey, I thought it was time for some new Shrink Wrap Radio music, and I sure hope you like this latest one. I also have a shorter version, which I'll place in the rotation for future shows. Thanks to the ever-fabulous Jeff Smith for setting it to music for me, and just the way I imagined it. I'm skipping my usual post-interview commentary. I think my own opinions come through pretty clearly in the interview, and I wanted to have some time for announcements and email. So, in the announcements category, first of all, thanks to everyone who took our poll on whether the APA should come out with stronger rules forbidding psychologists from being involved in military interrogations. 61% of you said yes, psychologists should be restricted from any such involvement. 32% disagreed with that, and 7% of you were undecided. So now you can take our new poll on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, which asks the question, how often do you worry? I'm also happy to announce that I recently received a couple of Skype communications from Mo, our Iraqi listener in Baghdad, who I interviewed on this show a couple of times. I'm happy to report that Mo is still alive and able to listen to Shrink Wrap Radio despite the stresses of life in Baghdad. Hang in there, Mo. Here's hoping better days are ahead. Speaking of listeners, you've probably heard me read emails from Lloyd, a longtime listener and supporter in Australia. He started his own podcast at www.elizapodcast.com. He uses a voice synthesizer to emulate the famous Eliza software, which acts like a Rogerian psychotherapist. So Lloyd is speaking as openly and honestly as possible about his life and his concerns, and then in the voice of Eliza is making his own therapeutic interventions. I know he'd love it if you'd take a listen and leave a comment. The address again is www.elizapodcast.com, and Eliza is spelled E-L-I-Z-A, or Z, for those of you in South Africa and elsewhere. Speaking of leaving comments, you might recall Anne is a man, and the man, Anna, the mana, whom you've heard here more than once. And he's keeping a blog where he fairly regularly reviews Shrink Wrap Radio and the Wise Counsel podcasts. And his blog is sorely lacking in comments. So please drop by and leave a comment or two for Anne. I'm sure he'd appreciate it. He's a big supporter of the shrink wrap community idea, and you'll find it at http://anisaman.blogspot.com. That's anisaman.blogspot.com. And speaking of my other podcast series, Wise Counsel, you'll find a new interview there with Dr. Joni Gillespie, who I also interviewed here about cyber sex, if you recall. And the Wise Counsel interview is a completely different interview, focusing on advice for parents and therapists in relation to the whole cyber world and use of the internet. You'll find that interview along with a free written transcript at www.wisecounselpodcast.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Susie calling from Vancouver, and I'm really excited to announce the new Facebook group that I've created called the Shrink Wrap Radio Fan Club. You can find the link on Shrink Wrap Radio website, or just search for Shrink Wrap in Facebook. That's all for now. Bye-bye.
Susie, what a cool idea. I'm so flattered to have a Shrink Wrap Radio fan club, at least if people actually join, that is. An idea that I've toyed with but haven't implemented is to create a forum on the Shrink Wrap Radio site so that listeners could dialogue with one another and further build the sense of community. And I think Susie's idea of a group on the Facebook social networking site could perhaps accomplish the same thing. So you'll find a link to it in the green gutter area on the right of the shrinkwrapradio.com pages. And you don't need to already be a Facebook member, and you don't need an invitation other than the one you just heard from Susie. You'll be able to sign up right from that link on my website and communicate with other shrink wrap folks interested in such things as psychology, spirituality, personal growth, dreams, and so on. So, Susie, thanks for taking this initiative. Now, we have three new additions to our Frapper map. Jesse from Orlando, Florida, welcome. Jose Luis in Porto Alegre, Brazil, who may be our first and only listener in Brazil. Hey, Jose Luis, spread the word down there, would you? And Rona in Los Angeles, who says, the education you provide is great. Thanks. If you're not on our Frapper map yet, there's a place on the Shrink Wrap Radio website where you can add yourself to the Shrink Wrap Radio Frapper map. And the sponsors for this show are, of course, Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase at GoDaddy. I know a number of you have taken advantage of these discounts. You'll find more discounts on my website. Not long ago, I used GoDaddy to buy CelebrityShrink.com, .net, .info, and .biz, and pointed them all at ShrinkWrapRadio.com. I used the discount, and I saved myself a bundle using my own discount code. Haven't done anything, really, with that celebrity idea so far, however.
Hi, this is Dr. Michael Pinkston from Santa Rosa, California. And I'm at the ISAD Dream Conference, and you're in a lucid dream with Dr. Dave.
Thanks to my good friend Michael Pinkston. It was good to see him at the Dream Conference, and I hope I'll get him in as a guest at some point. So that's a good transition to get us into reading some email. And the first one says, hi, Dr. Dave, I love, and lots of O's in it, I love your podcast and have listened to every one. Wow. I am an MFT, that stands for Marriage Family Therapist, intern in limbo, taking the first exam preparing for the last. I share your interest and appreciation for the depth psychology perspective and think that Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Women Who Run with Wolves, would make an excellent guest. What do you think? Well, I think so too. I've thought so for some time. And she's definitely on my to-do list, and I just need to figure out how to get in touch with her. But I really appreciate that reminder, Rachel. And she closes off her note, keep up the good work, Rachel. I got an email from a Dr. Lucy Jo Palladino, who writes, Hi, Dave, thanks for your reply. You'll be receiving a copy of Find Your Focus Zone from my publisher, Simon & Schuster. A friend who is a longtime listener and a graduate student in psychology told me about your show. She said my book would be a perfect fit, so I visited your site. I listened to about half a dozen of your shows, and I think it's a good match. See what you think. So, Lucy Jo, I'm looking forward to receiving your book, and hopefully it will be a good match, and look forward to interviewing you. She goes on to say, regardless of whether you decide Find Your Focus Zone is right for your show, I'd like to thank you for reading Mary Pfeiffer's, or actually it's Mary Pfeiffer's, return of her presidential citation letter in its entirety on the air. That was the letter in which she turned down this prize from the American Psychological Association out of an objection to their stance or their failure to take a strong enough stance on the business about psychologists being consultants in military interrogations. Now, she goes on to say, I was at the convention in San Francisco and felt proud to be a psychologist. The programs were rich, stimulating, and plentiful, but every day, Thursday to Monday, I walked past the protesters on my way in and out of Moscone South, Moscone being the convention center. I had an active schedule from early morning to late night, but not once did I hear about Pfeiffer's letter on or the true nature of the resolution on torture controversy in the same clear way you presented it on Shrink Wrap Radio. Best regards, Lucy Jo. Lucy Jo, it's great to hear from another psychologist and to get your endorsement that, in fact, I did give a clear presentation. So I'm glad that this show is useful to psychologists as well as to just kind of average folks who are very interested in psychology and all along the line. I received a couple of emails from Patrick, who is both a listener and also a podcaster, and he was alerting me to the fact that there was a fair amount of hiss on some of my recent shows in the during the interviews, and he has generously offered to help me work on that issue, and I have Skyped him several times, and we've done some troubleshooting, and hopefully I'm getting on top of that. That wasn't a problem on the shows for a long time, and then suddenly I began to wrestle with that issue. I keep thinking I've got my sound issues all resolved, and then something like that'll come along. So thanks a lot for your help, Patrick. I received a number of emails from Anna the Man in Israel, and here's one that I can share a part of. Hi, David. It's been a long time since I've let you hear from me, so I'll have to pile the various amounts of feedback and updates into one mail, just to let you know I'm still around, in case you wondered. First thing on my list is to write in my blog about your interview with Ed Tick. That issue can soundly be grouped with the very best of Shrink Wrap Radio. What a great conversation, and what compelling and inspiring thoughts have come up. I suggest you could invite Dr. Tick some more. It seems you haven't begun talking yet. The thought also comes up very strongly to see if I could get him to visit Israel for lectures and workshops. We have our fair share of souls scarred by hell, one of which I witness every day. A veteran lives next door and he roams the street like a living corpse. He's heavily sedated, and so the neighbors tell, otherwise his battle traumas will throw him into a frenzy. Thus, he aimlessly wanders between the synagogue and his parents' house, which is the same apartment building where we live, unshaved and dressed in rags. He can't be much younger than me, so his state is likely the result of the very first Lebanon War, which raged in the early 80s, 20 years of living in a haze. What good work Dr. Tick could do with him, I'm sure. You know, that's a great suggestion. I don't know if Ed Tick has done any work in Israel or not, but I really would encourage you to contact him through his website, as I did. You can get in touch with him, or I'll be happy to share his email address with you so that you could contact him to make that suggestion. Anna goes on to say, I was so happy to get a shout-out from Nir on your show. How good to hear that he liked my interview, and I take this opportunity to compliment him on the great music he composed for you. Would you kindly pass this on? Feel free to give Nir my contact details. Okay, I need to remember to do that. And Nir, if you're listening, Anna, I gave his blog address earlier in the show. And if you go to his blog, I think you'll find his email there. And Anna would love to hear from you, Nir. And Anna goes on to say, another close-to-the-skin experience was offered by listener Larissa, whose mail you read on the second APA show. I do not know her personally, but since she is also from Almelo, she and I have very likely attended the same high school, as this is exactly the area of the Netherlands where I grew up before I left to study in Amsterdam. And he says, hope all is well. Best, Anna. And I think I will close with one last letter, which comes all the way from Finland. And it reads, hello, Dr. Dave. My name is Tommy. I'm a listener from Finland. I'm not a student or a professional. I'm just a person interested in various things, psychology being one of them. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for about a year now, and I finally added myself to the Frapper map. Yay! And I also filled out the survey, since you've been asking so often for people to do that. I wrote to you to offer a couple of suggestions for guests for the show. The first one is a therapist called Jack Willis, who recently opened a website where he offers a free ebook about Wilhelm Reich's body-based psychotherapy. The site is www.reichiantherapy.net. And the book contains instructions for doing physical exercises on your own. I heard Jack Willis some times ago when he was a guest on another podcast called Beer O'Clock, it looks like, but the podcast stopped and the episode is unfortunately no longer available. They talked about what is good therapy and also briefly talked about a book called The Psychopath's Bible, which he co-authored. The second one is a guy called Christopher Arufalo. He has a website where he writes about his guests to create a method for people to learn perfect pitch. That is the ability to pick out notes from music by just listening. The website is www.acousticlearning.com. This topic is not strictly about psychology, but there's a bit of psychology involved, so it might be suitable for your show. Also, I liked the personal stories that you used to tell about catching the pig and the others. The pig story I remember best. I remember you asked for feedback on the stories. I meant to write you then, but I never got around to it. That's all I can think of to say about the show right now. I hope you continue to make this great show. Hey, Tommy, thanks so much for that feedback, for writing from all the way from Finland. You might be my first listener in Finland. I'm not sure. Maybe not, though. Actually, I'm remembering. Well, I interviewed somebody in Finland. Maybe that's what I'm thinking about. And I'm so glad you like the personal stories. I enjoy doing those. Maybe I'll dig up another one or two. Those are kind of my best and favorite ones. But out of such a long life, you'd think I'd have some more. Of course, they're not all fit for telling in a public setting. So, but maybe I can come up with something. So I think that better wrap it up for email today. I'd love to hear from you. You'll find the contact information at shrinkwrapradio.com, where there are lots of different ways to get in touch. Thanks again to Dr. David Lukov for sharing his work on spiritual emergencies and the development of spiritual competencies. I'm not sure who my next guest will be. I have a couple of feelers out, and either one of them will make for a great show. Now, if they'll only get back to me with a date and time. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.